Good morning. This is Brad Lacey, pastor of First Baptist Church at Conshohocken, president of the Philadelphia Bible Society, and for this hour, host of The Great Message on Talk Radio 1210, WPHT. My blessing and privilege to share conversation for the full length of the hour with Mr. Matthias Pertula, who is the Southeast Asia Advocacy Director for International Christian Concern, a wonderful ministry on behalf of our persecuted brethren around the world. Matthias has joined us many times, a true friend to this broadcast. Mr. Matthias, welcome back.
It's an honor to be here again, sir. Always love spending time with you, Brad.
Well, it's a joy, Matthias. And as you know, I mean, it's clearly the case with you. It's your vocation. For me, I have long held a heart for the persecuted believers around the world, as does my church. It saddens me, actually, that one doesn't hear as much conversation and concern throughout much of the Church of Jesus Christ in the West. I'm always at a loss. I'm sure that you are as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing thing for us at ICC, and I think other ministries that really focus on serving the persecuted church. But people are awake. They're awaking now. I mean, there are things that are happening even in the West now that are starting to grab some attention here. And people are starting to understand that religious liberty and the freedoms that we enjoy are somewhat finite, you know, and that's something that, you know, we have to keep fighting for. And people are beginning to understand that living life as a Christian overseas in some of these countries that we work in is very different and very, very, very difficult what they face.
Yes, and in my opening remark, I don't mean to sound derisive. I'm saddened by the lack of awareness that I find amongst many of my colleagues. But, you know, I think what happens, Matthias, we easily all get stuck within a box. So however we were trained, maybe there were certain issues back in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s during the training of many of my peers. And we continue to take our cues from those things. And some of them may still have validity, but it's a whole new ball game now. And but yet we still operate within a rather stale box, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so. And there's, you know, you're referencing kind of 70s and 80s. And I think kind of back in those days, it was the great Soviet Union that was doing the most of the persecution, and alongside some of the other communist countries in the world that just, you know, forbade Christianity, God, any form of religious expression. It's kind of interesting to bring that up since, you know, Gorbachev actually just passed away yesterday. You know,
and he was didn't hear that, did he?
Yeah, just passed away in Moscow. He was there, and you know, I guess he was living in Santa Barbara, but went back to Moscow and passed away. And but you know, he was the last leader of the USSR, and you know, after that, you know, the Soviet Union broke up and really kind of opened up the gospel, opened up the gates for the gospel to come into Eastern Europe and to former communist Russia. But, you know, as you say that today, it's different. You know, persecution takes so many different forms around the world. From, yeah, we see the violent attacks, but so many times it's subtle. It's embedded in different cultural layers, societal fabric, ethnicity, even sometimes. All kinds of factors go into play now. And it almost creates like a sense of normalcy for a lot of Christian communities, like in Pakistan, in India, and other countries in the world. You know, you're born into a Christian family, and you're raised as a Christian, so life is going to look very different to you as opposed to perhaps a Muslim in Pakistan.
Matthias, when you came to First Baptist Church at Conshohocken back in, I believe it was early June, you focused more upon those subtle but very real and pressing cultural differences that Christians must go up against, more so than you did the issue of imprisonments or torture or the like. Before we get into this, however, in specific locales, you mentioned Mikhail Gorbachev. If I'm not mistaken, at one time, he did make a public Christian profession. He may have backpedaled or soft-pedaled later, but there was something that came forth from him. I remember he was giving a talk at some large congress of sorts in Europe. And he made the comment, and I remember the qualifier from the news person, that you could hear a pin drop amongst these European elites. He said something to the effect that we must never forget Jesus Christ. And of course, that wasn't, let's just say that was more persona non grata to these elites. But Gorbachev had the moxie to say it. I don't know if you have any insight into his spiritual life or lack thereof.
You know, I wish I did, but I've heard similar stories. And for someone who, you know, ruled the Soviet Union in the twilight of its existence, you know, and was, you know, really despised by the old guard with his reforms and things, I'm not surprised that, you know, Gorbachev would make a statement like that. I personally like to believe that he really went through a kind of a personal awakening about the whole situation. Really was a young reformist really in his time. I think in his mid-50s was actually elected into the general secretary role and brought about a lot of reforms that were not popular. And I like to think that he went through some sort of a personal epiphany, I suppose, as to what religious life is and what Christ is all about. Maybe Reagan had something to do with that.
Well, there was some indication from him, even more so than that particular anecdote. Although it's also true that his wife was, I think he was deeply in love with her, and no doubt she with him, but she was a hardened atheistic professor of philosophy, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know what kind of influence, for better or worse, she would have had upon him.
I can't speak to the personal nature of that. I wish I could.
Well, I was, and you are blessed with a wife who loves the Lord, and money doesn't buy
it? It does not.
By any stretch. But Matthias, you wanted to bring to our attention this morning the issue and plight of persecution at play in the African nation of Nigeria. And I know it has been described there for Christians as a literal hell on earth. And I think you even gave affirmation to that when last we spoke. So please pick up where we left off concerning Nigeria.
No, thank you. And Nigeria is a really, for ICC, it's really been a focus country for us this year in particular. And there's a couple of driving factors for that. And one of them is they were listed by the State Department as a country of particular concern. And literally what that means, it's State Department gives designations to countries where religious freedom is very much on the decline. But last year, for the first time ever in history of the State Department doing these designations, Nigeria was on the list 1 year and immediately after was taken off with no explanation given as to why. No, the conditions did not improve. In fact, they've gone worse or continued exactly in the same direction. So that really prompted us and the religious freedom community here in DC to make a big deal about this. This is unprecedented. The violence continues to grow against Christians. I mean, we see that really from two main sources, or three. There's Boko Haram, there's ISWAP, ISIS West Africa, and of course the Fulani militants, which is primarily a sub-Saharan ethnic group, about 90% Muslim. There's a militant wing within that ethnic group that continues to go and attack Christian villages all around the center, really, of Nigeria, the middle belt, as we call it. But what we've seen over the last couple of months, and maybe even going back 6 months now, these attacks have started to come further down into south. In fact, we saw a big church bombing not long ago, about 2 months ago now, or 3 months ago even. It was a Catholic church. They were going to, it was Sunday morning, was bombed. I think it was close to 50 people or so died in that attack. And what was unique about this attack in particular was that it was happening in the south now, where we usually see the violence in the middle part of Nigeria. This is showing that it's making its way down to the south. Very concerning trends there. And we need to be praying. We need to be doing more. And the State Department, we're really advocating again for this designation to be placed on Nigeria as a country of particular concern.
Matthias, is there any sympathy within the Nigerian government or power structure at large that is expressed towards Christians? Any meaningful
sympathy? That's a great question. Nothing really that meaningful, I would say, from my perspective. And what we're seeing, even with this bombing, the president, I believe, did not even personally remark on it. He sent his press secretary or staffer to offer some comments of solidarity. But at the same time, it does not seem like a very heartfelt response from the nation's leader. When imagine if a bombing like this were to happen in Arizona or somewhere, I think President Biden would be on TV immediately expressing sympathy, solidarity with the community that was affected by it. I mean, to not respond in a meaningful way is just atrocious.
There's a thought that comes to mind, but I must hold until after the break to share it with you. Matthias Pertuller of International Christian Concern, Brad Lacey with First Baptist Conshohocken. We return with a great message in just a moment. Thank you. Brad Lacey and Matthias Pertuller, the Southeast Asia Advocacy Director for International Christian Concern, a marvelous watchdog ministry on behalf of our persecuted brethren. We've been discussing the plight of Christians in Nigeria. And Matthias, you were sharing the fact that the president of Nigeria offered a word of condolence, if you will, on behalf of the bombing against Catholic Christians a couple of months ago. And yet it didn't seem to be particularly heartfelt. And something that has always struck me, and I want to be very careful here, because you will meet people from Muslim or Islamic, the Islamic world, or the Hindu world, you will meet the Buddhistic world, you will meet some wonderful people who have genuinely humane and compassionate deportments. But my experience has been in large measure that outside of the Judeo-Christian heritage, outside that is of a world that has been touched and even permeated by the ethic of our gospel or of the Judeo-Christian enterprise, when you bring people together, the cultural extensions are not always pretty towards those who are not of like mind or who look alike. Would that be an accurate appraisal?
Yeah, and especially when it comes to a Christian identity, a lot of times there is a stigma that gets attached to Christian communities as a foreign religion and not really a part of the original community of that country. My perspective, that's not really true. We see a lot of this happening in India, for instance, where there's a big movement of what's known as Hindutva to make India a Hindu-only nation, in the sense like Muslims, Christians, no one else is welcome there. Or they must become Hindu, something to that effect. But often the case is made by these extremists that, well, these religions, you know, they're not really, haven't been in India. They were not the original religion. They came. But, you know, I always say, well, St. Thomas brought the gospel to northern India, you know, in the first century. So I think that we're, for two millennia, is a pretty long time to be in a country that it's, you know, expanded there, and lots of Christian communities have been there since then. So to make that case Christianity has been around for 2,000 years. I mean, so go ahead.
I don't know if I've ever told you the story. When I was over, I used to do some teaching in Chennai back in the late 90s. I'd go over for short-term assignments, 1997, 98, 99. Three-week, five-week, and six-week tours, and I loved it. In one of those years, I was taken to the Church of St. Thomas, where ostensibly they have the bones of the great apostle, okay? You go down these steps, and they're behind a window. And, I mean, who am I to say that they are or they're not, right?
Right.
But there was this very lovely petite little, well, petite is little, redundant, forgive me, this petite elderly Indian nun, and she was telling us all about the bones. And I say this with sweet affection. Yeah. I said, sister, do we know for certain that these are the bones of St. Thomas? And I'm telling you, Matthias, she looked at me with steel in her eyes. And she said, well, of course we do. I just backed away. I wasn't going to argue with her.
Don't mess with
but,
the nuns.
You know, don't argue with nuns. And I love them. She was sweet until I asked the question. I've never forgotten it. But be that as it may, I do remember the quote from it might very well be the current president from several years back. We will drive Christians into the sea. I mean, it was a very formidable and threatening statement that he made. A guy who ostensibly, by appearance, comes across as a sweetheart. But we all remember the gentleman who oversaw the revolution in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini. He was considered to be a very quiet, pacifistic academic in Paris until he was given the reins of power. And then he became a monster. We now have monsters running Afghanistan, the second nation that you've mentioned you'd like to address. So please take it from here.
Yeah, Afghanistan, you know, we launched last year with the withdrawal of U.S. and other allied forces. We actually just rolled over the anniversary of that date of really what we call like the fall of Kabul back to the Taliban, August 15th of 2021. So we felt that it was necessary for us to raise the profile again of the Christian community in Afghanistan and to remind people that there are lots of Christians still left there, a community that we believe number between 10 to 12,000 Christians. We don't know the exact numbers because it's so secretive and it's a loose house church network throughout the country that operates in like extreme secrecy. Obviously, if they're found out, life is going to get a lot harder for them. But we wanted to remind people that the Taliban, you know, when they first took power, they kind of were messaging to the world that they had these reforms and they had they were not the old Taliban and that they were going to be different this time around. Well, I'm here to tell you they're not. They're the same. They're probably even worse than what they were before. Just a few weeks ago, in fact, we got footage of one of these Taliban leaders in a province in Afghanistan, I won't say where, essentially beheading a Christian, known Christian, right on camera there in front of the entire community, just sending fear and shock into that community that if you practice Christianity, if you follow Jesus, this is what's going to happen to you. And even worse, if you try to convince others to follow Jesus, this is what's going to happen to you. They haven't reformed. They're a brutal, evil, wicked regime.
Matthias, I remember reading stories back in the stories that relate to the Bay of Pigs invasion with Cuba back in the early 60s. And the Americans had promised the Cuban rebels military support. And in the final analysis, for whatever reasons, President Kennedy pulled the support at the last minute. And I remember reading of CIA operatives just so sick that they got drunk and they were throwing up all night. They were so sickened. These were their friends. They were being forced to abandon. I'm curious, with whatever connections, and I'm not looking, I understand discretion is the greater rule of valor here. But surely you know people within the State Department who were just sickened by those events, I'm sure.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, to speak for this, well, I mean, I'm not speaking for the State Department, but, you know, that was a chaotic couple of weeks trying to get American citizens that were in Afghanistan out, people that were on a green card status, any kind of visa status that they were in. And you saw the footage of just the utter chaos that ensued in that entire city. With the bombings, the violence, you know, several service members were killed. So they were up against a very, very difficult job. But even then, the religious minorities that were there, Christians in particular, and we spoke to some of them that were able to escape, even among some of the evacuees, they were outed as Christians and even there lambasted for being Christians among the refugees who are being evacuated from Afghanistan. It was pretty heart-wrenching to see that you know, these people who are able to leave Afghanistan and leave Taliban control were perpetuating a lot of the same sentiments toward these other refugees who were just Christians, but they were all in the same plight, if you will. So there was a lot of noise during that time, a lot of different chaotic kind of messages coming, and we're having to figure out what is true, who's in charge, where are these Christians, and where are these people that we're trying to help? So the State Department had a huge task ahead of them.
Yeah, and I'm sure there just were hearts and minds that were just wrenched with grief over it, no doubt. Oh. But Matthias, forgive me. Once again, we're up against the clock. We will come back. We'll get two extra minutes in the next round. Brad Lacy and Matthias Pertula, we return in a moment.
This program is paid for by First Baptist Church of Conshohocken.
Brad Lacy and Matthias Pertula, who is the Southeast Asia Advocacy Director for International Christian Concern, a truly splendid and fruitful ministry on behalf of our persecuted brethren around the world. Matthias joins me for yet another round of the great message on Talk Radio 1210, WPHT. Matthias, I ask a question of the former leadership of Afghanistan, similar to that that I posed concerning Nigeria. The leadership prior to the takeover by the Taliban would have been probably with exclusive measure Islamic or Islam. But, I mean, was there ever any indication of amongst that leadership, even a small minority of leaders who manifested some degree of sympathy for our Christian brethren?
Yeah, so during that time, there was, during the 20-year war, basically, not right at the outset, but throughout it, there were definitely spots where Christians felt more comfortable being a little bit more open. So there's definitely some small, you know, bright spots throughout that entire time that kind of, I mean, there are several folks that were actually publicly, you know, came out as Christians, you know, but they're converts from Islam, but even then was frowned upon in the society, definitely still is even now. But there was definitely a little bit more of a sense of security and a sense of freedom, I guess, to be a little bit more open about your faith.
I would imagine that the presence of American boots on the ground, as we are wont to say, was of great value to Christians.
I think so. To some extent, definitely.
Yeah. I realize it can't parlay across the boards, but certainly, even, look, on the one hand, I don't mean to minimize anything, but even minimal help is still help. Praise God. But we would wish that it could be maximized beyond measure. But look, turning from Islamically controlled worlds, the Islamicists, perhaps, as distinct from the rank and file of the Muslim population. We look now to the West, the world in which you and I inhabit. And while we're not being imprisoned or tortured or executed, we are beginning to discover that our religious liberties are at least coming under question, to put it mildly. Please pick up with this, Matthias. You would know more than I.
So, you know, at ICC, we've kind of traditionally been a lot more internationally focused, but more and more we're seeing stories and cases come out about this and that Christian, you know, in whatever country in the West, you know, facing some sort of challenges. There was a difficult challenges, and what's been very concerning over the last 2 years, one case and a couple of cases come to mind. One of them was a teacher or he was a chaplain at a school in England, somewhere in the UK, had given a talk on sexuality, essentially, to the students, kind of countering a little bit more to what was being propagated in the societies, and kind of saying that, you know, it's okay to believe, you know, that there are two genders, you know, marriages between man and a woman. He delivered this sermon to the students and was fired subsequently after that. This case caught, obviously, as you can imagine, a lot of attention, international attention, but it just kind of went to show the sentiments that we're seeing in the West. I mean, we're talking about Western liberal democracies and that this kind of action is being taken. Of course, there's the case out of Finland that I've mentioned before. The former interior minister of Finland, a current member of Finnish parliament, being taken to court by the equivalent of the Finnish attorney general under criminal charges for posting tweets and for publicizing in pamphlets the biblical stance on gender and sexuality and these kinds of things. In fact, the general prosecutor has called the Bible equivalent to Mein Kampf, if you can believe that, saying that it's okay to have a copy of the Bible and in the library where you can maybe cite it, but it should be illegal, I repeat, illegal for you to believe what the Bible says. I mean, just outrageous statements that, well, I mean, hardly can believe that I'm hearing this.
I can tell you, Matthias, given my work with the Philadelphia Bible Society, I was at a meeting that was being overseen by the granddaddy of them all, the American Bible Society, formerly out of New York, now out of Philly. And whether it was the American Library Association or some comparable group of that magnitude, all right, I mean, a heavy hitter in that world, they listed the Bible as one of the 10 most dangerous books in the world. The Bible, you know, I mean, it's staggering. And we've had our heads in the sands for so long. I mean, parents are now waking up to what's being taught in the public schools. But churches, we need to be waking up as well. You know, I think of the chaplain in England. I mean, England was that's where the gospel went forth. It went forth from merry old England, courtesy of the King James Bible and missionaries of just noble devotion. And Finland is one of the Scandinavian nations that has the cross in the flag for reasons germane to their Christian foundations. How sad and even pathetic that we have plummeted to such a nadir.
But that's the tenor of culture in the West right now. That's what's being celebrated, is this anti-Christian sentiment, unfortunately. But, you know, like I always like to say that, you know, a lot of times these attacks come at, like, you know, Christians they're bigoted, so on and so forth. And our way is the only way, right? Having this sentiment within kind of the secularist atheistic kind of what we would kind of see maybe as the left wing in terms of political terms. But, you know, it's our way or the highway, essentially, is what they're saying. Whereas when Christians, I hope that you would believe in Jesus, but I can't force you and I never will. I can't do that. I will not do that. That is up to you. But I always like to turn the tables on them and say that, well, what about my freedom to believe and to practice my faith? Why is that freedom less than anything else? It should be equal across the board in that sense, if I make any sense in that sense.
To be sure, Matthias, I think when push comes to shove, at root, it's something that Jesus said in the Gospel of John, or whether it was Jesus, forgive me, or the apostle giving his extrapolation in John 3, but the darkness does not care for the light. And those who are in the darkness, they love their dark deeds, and they hate that which is of the light. And Jesus told us the same thing, didn't he? If they hated me, they will hate you without a cause. I think we are beginning to reckon with this.
Yeah, and I would say even this, though, you know, like while we see these cases happening and the sentiment is there, but it's important to highlight the hope here as well and the positive side. The Finnish MP has been acquitted in the court cases. You know, she's won the case. And in many respects, even in the court of public opinion, she has triumphed in many ways. The case is now being appealed by the Attorney General, the General Prosecutor of Finland, to the higher court, which I expect will come down on Päivi's, the Finnish MP's side. Because there really is no grounds within that accusation to condemn her for what they're accusing her of. So there's victories happening. We saw the Coach Kennedy case out of Virginia that came down the right way. Religious freedom triumphed in that sense. We've seen a lot of wins in terms of religious freedom being protected. So I like to always highlight those good things, but also highlight the fact that just because we may win battles here and there, doesn't mean that we can sit back and just relax at this point, but we need to keep up. We need to keep up with it, keep standing up for the rights and freedoms that we have here, because as Reagan said, one of my favorite presidents, a generation away from diminishing.
I voted for him twice. It was a great privilege. I would vote for him a third time if circumstances would permit. You know, it's also true, and I want to be careful that my remark does not smack of triumphalism. That's not my intent. But it is helpful and encouraging to know that several of our Supreme Court justices are men and women of genuine Christian conviction. Samuel Alito and Amy Comey Barrett are devout Catholic believers. I believe they know the love of Christ. And you have some Protestant figures as well, Clarence Thomas, clearly, like Scalia, who was a Catholic, his Christian convictions carry great weight for him. And yet, my impression is that these men and women do comport themselves with integrity, balancing their Christian convictions with what the law says.
Yeah, I would say,
but it's very encouraging.
Yeah, it is, and I attest to everything you said right there. I mean, that is reading the law as it was and as it is to be interpreted. I mean, and when you look at the Constitution, it is clear religious freedom is protected, and it shall not. You can't take it away from us. It's in the First Amendment, the first freedom.
And I believe it was my boy from Boston, John Adams. I'm a great student and admirer of Adams. It was Adams who made the comment that the United States Constitution, the one under which we live, its authority, without a religious people to practice it, that Constitution is worthless. Adams recognized that 250 years ago or thereabouts. I think we're seeing the fruit or lack thereof of an irreligious people. The Constitution cannot be sustained. But Matthias Bertula and Brad Lacey, we return for a final round of The Great Message in just a moment. Thank you. Brad Lacey and Matthias Bertula, the Southeast Asia Advocacy Director for International Christian Concern, just a superb ministry that ministers widely and deeply on behalf of our persecuted brethren around the world. Matthias joins me for a final round of The Great Message on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. I'll simply make mention of the fact that Matthias joined me and our church back in early June. He came up from D.C. for a luncheon. He gave a talk to I think we had 50, 60 people thereabouts. Matthias, I think I relayed to you how well received you were, but let me communicate also to the audience who are listening to us today. You gave a wonderful talk. Your presence was what really touched our people, let alone what you had to say. I am so grateful for your coming up.
Well, it was a wonderful gathering, and I was honored to be there. Great group of people and just salt of the earth. I could tell right away when we walked in what a great gathering it was. Just awesome people there. Gave me a little bit of a hard time here and there, but that's okay. I love that.
Well, Matthias, you know, we have to make certain that you don't lose your grip on things. You know, it keeps you sharp and focused, okay? It was a beautiful day, and I'm so grateful to you. Question for you before we turn to the ICC annual report, going back to our brief conversation concerning the West. What is the current status of the Baker out in Colorado? My understanding is that though he was vindicated, at least in part, the attorney general for the state of Colorado was still going after him.
Yeah, so I'm not totally sure on where the case is right now, but if my memory serves me correctly, obviously he was acquitted from that first case. But subsequently, he's actually in the middle of another set of, I believe, three separate lawsuits still fighting these same cases. But it just goes to show that there is a militant element to this very secularist movement, just hell-bent on going after this guy, making an example of him. It's very sad. So I would actually even recommend folks listening for even more updates on this, ADF International, Alliance Defending Freedom. They're a great organization that do also a lot of great work in this front. They would have some great information on their website.
So I believe his name is Jack Phillips. Am I correct?
Yeah.
So he's not being left alone. There are allies who have come forth to stand with him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, praise God for that. Speaks to the ruthlessness of the I'm going to say the secular left. It's ruthless. Mm-hmm. It has no mercy.
Like I said, it's almost like a militant feeling that you're getting from this kind of active pursuit. And it's not just Jack Phillips. He's just one of the individuals that's getting it. There's others across the country that are in the similar gauntlet, if you will, of this kind of secularist push to eliminate religion from public square and force everybody to believe exactly how they believe, essentially.
And if you will, it's playing out in a borough town or city near you, perhaps the one in which you live,
to be sure.
I've noticed, and I want to be very careful, I've not experienced any, nor am I suggesting that there's any overt anti-religious expression within the town in which I live. But I have noticed a change of tone. You get the sense now that there's respect, but it's not like the old days when the church was recognized as an organ of Almighty God.
Yeah.
Something has shifted now away from that. And even where things remain reasonably congenial, it's just not quite as it once was.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not meaning to suggest that I or my Christian colleagues here in my hometown are under any kind of pressure. We're not, but there is a tone shift.
Yeah. I don't think that you're alone in that. I think people across the country are feeling it, certain areas for sure. But it's a real decline in, how do I put it? I don't know, spirituality or just the fact of people not wanting to go to church anymore. I mean, there's just a real trend to move away from anything religious. And I think we've seen it coming. And I think we're really feeling the effects of it at this point. I mean, a lot of people like to point to the fact that you can't pray in school anymore, take prayer out of schools, all these kinds of these steps that were taken, you know, years ago are now manifesting in full effect. I mean,
well, we're also observing a rise in the interest in witchcraft here in my hometown, outside of Philadelphia, where we'll be receiving a witchcraft store within two blocks of my church very soon. I didn't know that witches get licensed. Apparently the lady's been licensed as a witch for 17 years. I didn't know you licensed witchcraft. And then the Barnes & Nobles up the street in the bargain book section, there's a whole aisle devoted to books on witchcraft.
Yeah.
And this is now becoming more and more celebrated as distinct from a day when the gospel carried great sway. But we want to just shift gears. You and I were talking about a wonderful document that you guys produce on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. It takes quite a bit of effort, and I think it's worthy of being highlighted. The International Christian Concern Annual Report regarding the plight of persecuted Christians. Talk to us about
this. Yeah, so this is a pretty heavy lift for us as an organization. We spend a lot of time researching these topics. And we try to quantify it as much as we can into the report. Essentially, we want to highlight in the report the top persecutors around the world. And we categorize from three different categories. We name a country, we name an entity, and we name an individual. So that kind of helps, because persecution and this whole area that we work in is so diverse in terms of what is the source of persecution. So it's hard to say that it's just the government of Afghanistan. Well, it's really Taliban. Or is it the government of Nigeria, or is it the Fulani militants, which is an entity? So that's why we want to use the opportunity to highlight the different layers and the different sources of persecution. And this year, we decided to highlight Afghanistan. Obviously, it's run by Taliban, but because of what happened over the last year, just the level of brutality that has gone up, we quantified all into the report, shares a lot about what's happened there. And we want to use this as an opportunity to raise awareness, you know, to ring the bell, to wake people up, wake up the church, make them aware of what's happening. Our entity this year, we highlighted the Fulani militants. I mentioned them earlier, very active in Nigeria, attacking Christian communities and churches there. In our individual, actually, you already alluded to the Ayatollah in Iran. We decided to highlight him as our individual. Essentially, all of these, aside from the Fulani, are the government entities within those countries or those regions. The Ayatollah is essentially the government of Iran. Everything runs through him. Any major decision that happens has to run through him. Even elections have to be approved by him. The people running for office need to be approved by him. So everything is very centralized around him, and the same is very much true for the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Does your annual report carry any influence or clout with our State Department or elsewhere around the world? I'm sure it does.
Absolutely, and we hope that it continues to grow in its influence. So all the key stakeholders at the State Department and around Washington will get a copy of it. In fact, we launched our report at the International Religious Freedom Summit, which is an NGO-led Religious Freedom Summit. So we had a great showing there, and our ambassador for international religious freedom, Rashad Hussein, came and offered remarks there. We had several members of Congress send videos of encouragement and videos of acknowledgement of the report and of the work that ICC has been doing. So it was very, very well received. Yeah.
I praise God to hear it. I applaud you all for producing it, and I look forward to my copy. Praise the Lord. Matthias Petula and Brad Lacey, we wish you God's blessing. Do take care.